Ex-army man whose first tune was written on a London underground. That was James Blunt, of course, and Bonfire Heart. Remarkably catchy. OK, in the studio we have Katie Grimmison, we have Dr. Anna Maria Roos, and Anna Marie, we have a wonderful soul online now, which you are singularly responsible for actually bringing to the Midweek Drive team and ultimately to the University of Lincoln itself.
That's correct. We have a seminar series in the School of Humanities, and we like to promote and showcase research within the school and provide a forum for exchange of ideas and research collaborations.
I would love to attend, but it takes place at the same time as this show.
Yes, I know it does. Oh, it's maybe we can do it on the air sometime, Alex. What do you think?
Yeah,
I think it might be an idea.
I'd go with that, precisely.
Yeah. All right, and each term we have the pleasure of having an outside speaker come in and talk about their work, and Keith Moore, who is a Royal Society librarian, agreed to come in on the 20th of November from 4:15 to 5:30, Media, Humanities, Technology, Building, Room 24, to speak with us, and the title of this talk is very intriguing. It's Isaac Newton, The Apple Falls Far from the Tree, and I guess what I'd like to do is ask Mr. Moore if he could explain his title a little bit.
Keith, welcome to the show, first of all.
Hello there, hi.
And, I mean, we've already got another little Isaac Newton connection because Anna Maria has also turned around and said, Anna Marie, that Katie is wearing the perfect top for this whole Isaac Newton thing.
It's a comet. And I'm thinking about Hallie. You know how this goes, Keith.
Yeah. Hallie's comet scooting across her upper parts there, her upper torso. Marvellous. Keith, welcome along. Talk to us about your role as a Royal Society librarian extraordinaire.
Well, it gives me access to some very interesting manuscripts, including many by Sir Isaac Newton, who is, of course, still our most famous president. So one of the things we have is the Principia manuscript, of course, which is a rather fantastic thing.
And without, of course, the good Isaac Newton, we would not have put man on the moon. And it did happen, despite what some of the conspiracy theorists would say.
It certainly did happen.
Yeah. Absolutely.
There we are. It's Newtonian physics that still work in the macro world. I know when you get down to the quantum level of things, you say, it's all Einstein now.
That's right. Einstein had to come along and mess up the perfect Newtonian celestial mechanics, but we'll forgive him anyway.
And that was really at the heart of what Newton was actually arguing for, that actually God doesn't play dice with the universe, to use the Einstein quote, but to actually, you know, everything worked perfectly. And we can go back to Copernicus, and those would be lines from that. It's like a clockwork universe.
That's right. Nature had rules, and if we can figure those rules out, and that was part of what we would call, in quotes, the scientific revolution of the 17th century, and the Royal Society played a tremendous role in that. And we know that Isaac Newton was at the heart of that role, and Keith's going to come up and talk to us about that. And Isaac Newton had a lot of ties to Lincolnshire, didn't he, Keith?
He did. We had two leading 18th century presidents who were good, solid Lincolnshire men, Newton being the first and most famous, of course, but also Joseph Banks at the back end of the 18th century. Banks, I think, we would kind of accept as a Lincolnshire country gentleman as partly how he portrayed himself, but I think we tend to think of Newton as more of a Cambridge or a London man.
That's true, but Newton actually hatched some of his most beautiful ideas in Lincolnshire, didn't he, in 1665?
Yeah. And a lot of his early biographers do make that link to his home county, particularly William Stukeley and Humphrey Newton. These were men who lived and worked around Grantham, for example. And so their stories about Newton were partly practical because they were there where he had been as a child.
That's correct. Now, we do hear that in Woolsthorpe, Lincolnshire, Newton was fleeing from the plague in Cambridge in the 1660s, and he went home from Cambridge to get away from the epidemic disease, and he had his miracle year in Lincolnshire on the family farm. And this is supposedly where the apple came and hit him on the head, or he saw an apple fall, and he connected that with gravitational force. Now, Keith, you'd probably be better placed than anybody to tell us, is this story told by William Stukeley in his memoirs of Isaac Newton, is this a true story, or is it apocryphal? What's your take on it?
It's a story that Newton himself told to various people, so we have to accept it as true. However, he describes it in slightly different ways depending on who he's talking to.
Right.
With Stukeley, he says apple trees, so he's apparently sitting under more than one of them. So the idea that a particular tree is the right one is slightly more controversial.
Let's just test that. Katie, Newton and the apple. and the subsequent connection with gravity. Is this something which resonates with yourself? Do you remember the tale as a child?
I think so, yeah.
It's okay, because...
I think everyone does.
Always very concerned when we start talking about the general on that basis. Who knows what could happen on that basis, but pleased to see that, Katie, you could at least say yes to Newton. Before we move into some more Newton stuff, I'm just fascinated, Keith, by this question I have to ask you. Do you literally celebrate becoming the Society's librarian, that's the Royal Society's librarian, every year with fireworks on the 4th of July?
No, that was just the date I got the job.
Well, you see, I'm quoting from the Royal Society, the repository here.
That's right. You know, Keith, I'm disappointed. As an American, I thought you were breaking out, you know, the sparklers and all these things and waving them around. Now, come on now.
Yeah. Well, I shall absolutely have to this coming.
Well,
I'll make sure of it.
Evidently, you know, Institute of Mechanical Engineers and the Wellcome Institute, of course. And, of course, you started your career in literary libraries. I often say one of the great strengths of history is we need to know where we've been before we can work out where we're going. Anna Marie, from your perspective, what was it about science that particularly appeals to you? Because I'm a great believer in terms of the excitement and the dynamism and the fact that science is often portrayed as being dull and interesting, and you look at Principia Mathematica and you think, you know, but it's such a, you know, it's produced by a whole range of passionate people.
Science is beautiful and creative. I actually started out as a natural science. I was initially trained as a biologist, and I have immense respect for the complex intricacy of the natural world.
Krebs citric acid.
The Krebs cycle is still in my mind.
Exactly.
And, I think what got me very interested in the history of science, to be fair, when I was a science student, nobody really told me where the scientific method came from, and very much about the people that contributed to its formation, to the formation of scientific societies. And you know, I was one of those pesky students that asked a lot of questions, and the more questions I asked, the more I realized that, you know, history of science looks like a very interesting thing to study.
Regularly, Katie's just drawing her adenosine triphosphate molecules, her adenosine diphosphate molecules, and saying, that's what gives me the energy, that keeps me going.
She's got a comet on her shirt, so you know.
We've turned to life sciences as opposed to, obviously, the physical sciences, which I know physicists would say, but that's much more difficult. What inspired yourself, Keith, to head into obviously, the work with the Royal Society?
Well, I started out in literary libraries, so one of my first jobs was at Dove Cottage in Grasmere, Wordsworth's home. And I was very, very interested in how literary figures of that period, people like Samuel Taylor Coleridge, would very happily read things like the Philosophical Transactions. They would read scientific works as gentlemen, and they would take material away that they would use. And disciplines were far more fuzzy at that period. It's only in relatively recent times that science and the arts have gone separate ways, and hopefully that's turning around a little bit now.
I actually feel that having done a first degree in chemistry and biology and then a master's in film and media might have sort of hopefully paved the way back in the 80s, but you know.
It could be. Yeah. But I mean, I just think that I'd agree with Anna Marie about this. You know, science is absolutely, although I have a humanities background, science I find fascinating and rather beautiful and endlessly interesting from its historical perspective. There's always something new to learn.
Yeah. It's also, science has a really aesthetic quality about it. You know, when you figure out great laws of nature, they're simple, they're mathematically beautiful, natural forms, fractal geometry, all that sort of thing, they repeat. Nature's had a long time to design very beautiful creatures through their evolutionary process, and it's really, I think, marvelous that, you know, we can use our minds to figure out these basic laws and how these creatures were formed and why things move and why they grow and develop. And it's a really wonderful manifestation of human creativity and quest for knowledge.
And I think the reason we keep going back to people like Darwin and Newton is the stories of how these individuals managed to get to grips with particular parts of the natural world is just tremendously interesting. I mean, it really inspires people.
It does. And I mean, I'm thinking about Newton coming as a student back to that farmhouse in Lincolnshire, and he figured out the laws of visible light. He figured out the law of gravity. He figured out...
Well, let's face it, there weren't any PlayStations or Xboxes to work on.
That's right. And I mean, when you but think all in his mind, that's a phenomenal achievement. It's awe-inspiring. And it was out of that insatiable curiosity and quest to know. And that's exciting. I'm excited talking about it.
For a moment there, Anna Marie, I thought we were having a Carl Sagan moment. And we'll talk about Carl Sagan. We Rachel Worby later on in the show. Nikki Wells has just sent in a line saying, good luck to Ed Wellman. You'll do it. Well, we know he will. It's to write a dissertation we're worried about. She loved the start of the song, got confused by the rain, though. She thought her connection had broken down. It's all right, Nikki. You're still here. It's all based on sort of facts and various other figures and such like stuff. Katie, any questions you want to put to Keith about his work with the Royal Society and libraries and so on? Because you're becoming quite a bibliophile yourself, really, albeit from a kind of cultural theory perspective.
It's hard to think of a question, actually.
That's framing it. That's why Isaac did so well in the whole sort of system, really. A reminder, of course, that it is November the 20th when Keith will be coming to Lincoln. Maybe, perhaps we should get some fireworks out for that.
I think so. I think it'd be extremely appropriate. A
reminder.
So be warned, Keith.
It's almost the right time of year. I think fireworks would be good.
I think so, too.
It's just wonderful in every sense of the word. And it's in the media humanities, MHT 0024. Make you, if you know where the siren base is, you know where the building is. And it's sort of along from there, 0024. Details, obviously, follow will be able to come on the website and all sorts of other bits and pieces. Keith, it's just been a very short little smidgen, a little sample of the magic I know you're going to bring to Lincoln and a whole range of. In fact, I'm already thinking, really, Katie, we should do a location report to the Royal Society. Really, you should.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Be
up on that basis. But I've got to ask you two final questions. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic debut on the Midweek Drive today?
It's been fantastic, yes. Very interesting indeed. Always good to talk to Anna Marie again.
Oh, always nice to talk to you
there
too, Keith.
It's just wonderful. So can we look forward to hopefully featuring you again in the very near future?
Any time you would like me on, and I'll be there.
Of course, November the 20th, he'll be here in Lincoln in person. Yay! Teeny bit late going to Jersey. We'll be with you very, very shortly for notes from a very small island. Newton Faulkner and clowns there, and exciting times, I say, because November the 20th looks as though it's going to be a good time in Lincoln, doesn't it?
I think so. We have a lot to celebrate with a talk from Keith Moore about Newton, and maybe even some fireworks, as you suggested before.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But obviously, in a health and safety routine, you don't want to set fireworks off. I mean, Lord knows, Norman Cherry would be most upset.
He might be interested in the colours and things we picked.
True,
you know, from an aesthetic point of view.
Fair point. Exactly.
Yep, so there you go.
Always important. Katie, you've gone for Delphic in Halcyon.
Yes, I have. I love Delphic. You said enough, you said too much. You focus solely on her touch. In Halcyon.
With lashings of country news, science fiction views, top interviews and a clear audio news, it's the Midweek Drive on Siren 107.3 FM. Notes from a very small island can only mean it's time for our top Jersey correspondent, Anna Maria Lewis, on the Midweek Drive.
Recently returned, of course, from that strange and wondrous part of the world called Strawberry Hill. Isn't that right, Anna?
I got back last night.
You got back last night, you see?
I got back last night.
They let you back into the island after all of those people who said, once she's gone, she's never going to come back, let alone let her back. Amazing. So did you have an enjoyable time?
It was wonderful. The weather was really, really good as well, which helped. Yeah, it was great.
We've just spoken to librarian extraordinaire, head librarian, in fact.
Head librarian. He's the head honcho.
Head honcho at the Royal Society. In the studio, we have Dr. Anna Marie Roos, all the way originally from, I was going to say Connecticut there, but of course it's Colorado. You see, that's the kind of...
The rectangular
of,
state.
Exactly. The rectangular state. Exactly. Have you ever been to Jersey?
No, I have not. Oh. So I might have to visit.
These are the critical routines. Because I think it's fair to say, Anna, from your perspective, you're always more of a humanitarian as opposed to a scientist, even though it can be revealed now, she did used to hang out a lot with us Chemistry Society types. And in fact, you know, she joined the Chemistry Society on the grounds that we were a Chemistry Society that sort of did lots of strange and wacky things, a bit like the radio show. Well, in fact, why did you join the Chemistry Society, Anna Lewis?
Well, perhaps I ought to. It's just a sort of thing that one does.
No, I thought you did. I thought you did back in 1982, 83.
It's true. You know, do you remember the seance that was held in the billiard room where the equipment went funny?
Yeah,
that was not the seance, the talk.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. It was a talk where the equipment went funny.
Strange things happening, bumps in the night.
Yeah.
All right.
Strange things going on. Yeah.
This was in the house of Horace Walpole.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So you felt that you felt the spirits, did you? Mm-hmm. Did you feel politically inspired?
Well, there were all sorts of funny things going on that night, but the equipment breaking down and then suddenly resurrecting when they were outside the building, that really was spooky.
I blame the fact that we were working with people who were working at Birkbeck College. That was a critical side of things.
Oh, yes.
These things happen. It's inevitability. Sorry, Katie, we're talking about stuff that literally was happy before you were born. But never mind. Maybe you were the spirit who was actually there.
That's right.
It's important. So where do you sit, Anna, on this kind of debate between the sciences? Because, Dr. Rusi, you were turning around and saying that actually, to a large extent, we're moving away from that. In the 21st century, we're almost going back to the notion of the Enlightenment, that you can actually have Renaissance folk with understandings of both sciences and the arts.
We're going back to the idea of the virtuoso, one who can see the connections between different disciplines. And I do think it's been the boundaries of disciplines that we get creative insights. And I'm really happy to see that people are finally accepting science as something creative. I think it's a change in how it's been taught, too. It has a little bit to do with it. When I learned it at first, you have to learn the ropes. So they teach, you know, you do a chemistry experience kind of like a cookbook and you follow this and this is supposed to happen. But now they're having more open-ended questions that the students are doing, and they're seeing that actually formulating their own questions and making their own hypotheses is quite creative and exciting.
Your thoughts, Anna? I sense that obviously your time in the library, well, of course, I mean, your official role is basically you are Jersey's key librarian, the go-to girl.
Well, not really, because we're a local studies library, but it's true the technology is moving at such a rate now where Google Books have, like, for example, one example is Google Books have actually digitized so many of the texts that we call as sacred in our library, really old books that go back to the 1700s, 1800s. But you're right, you know, this talking about technology, not Jersey. There was something on the television this morning about children who were learning about computer programming at school. And it's something that's just really creative, and they can make computer programs to play music. Well, that's great, because in the olden days, kids just tap away at computers and that's all they get. They get what they tap into. But now the thinking process is to actually go beyond that and more like what they do in order to get that to that result. So I think science, as you said, the creativity in science is something to celebrate, and also that will appeal, I think, more to young folk, and the correspondence between science and other disciplines. Totally agree with that.
Singularity, of course, is what SF writers would actually say we could be heading to, where the computers actually start designing themselves, and ultimately the intelligence is there, and we wonder, why do we need these organic life forms called Homo sapiens for? We're Homo superior. Computer superior.
Well, Boston Technology was just in the BBC the other day designing robots that are based on animal structures, and they actually have now robots that can pounce and gallop and leap and really cover different terrains.
Robots that can pounce and gallop and leap, Katie Grimerson. How are you going to cope with that in Birmingham when you head back in the whole sort of system? Yeah. Are you frightened by the future, Katie, or is it something that
you embrace it.
Embrace it, good.
I love technology, and I wonder what the future's going to be like.
Whatever you make it, dear girl, whatever you make it. I think I might have given you the same speech, Anna, in various sort of ways. I didn't know. It's like time travelling. That's the important thing. What's your own view on this one, Anna? Do you get sort of frightened by the future, or do you sort of think, no, like Katie, I embrace it and welcome it?
I live in the past too much with the work I do, but I kind of understand that you can't always live in the past. And young people today are very privileged because they can access the past, but they have to think ahead. So we get quite a number of students come to us in the library looking at environmental issues that I've never even considered. There's a book called Outrageous Waves by a chap who sadly died some years ago. And I was able to ask him the ridiculous question of what the weather was like in June 1204. And, you know, he could give me an answer.
That's outrageous.
But he could also, his whole project was really based on global warming and sea tide recession and things like that. But he knew the past and he knew the future. And he was an elderly gentleman. So, you know, there are people out there, as you said, enlightened people who kind of see the future and they embrace it to some degree, and they also understand the past, not worship it or revere it too much. They just see the past as what, you know, what's come before.
Yeah, and I think too that the fact that digitization and having so many of these historical sources on the internet freely available to all, I know the Royal Society has an amazing set of documents turning the pages, including William Stukeley's memoir on Newton. We'll just bring that up, which you can actually look through it, you know, and read it for yourself. And it's a wonderful leveler. It's to, you know, knowledge is power. And if people have all possession of that knowledge, look what power they have, you know, to make decisions and to think about things. And that's what I like to see is these precious documents being made publicly available.
What was it about Lincoln, Anna Marie Roos, that actually led you to come here in terms of... Because, I mean, I'm thinking, obviously, Boulder, Colorado, Oxford, traditional notion from that point of view. Here we are, a new university undergoing what I like to refer to as instant tradition. Bang, here we are.
You got the cathedral to remind you of tradition,
well,
don't
exactly.
You?
And as I said, you know, there was originally a plan to actually, after Oxford, and it was deemed to be a reasonably good thing to have institutes of higher education. Let's go to Lincoln. Lincoln couldn't afford it, so they set up the second university in Cambridge. Understandable. There we are. But what was it about Lincoln that appealed to yourself?
It's a combination of things. First of all, the fact that it's a young and dynamic university that's shaping its identity and it's ambitious. And I have family in Lincolnshire. My husband is from Bardney, Lincolnshire, and he went to grammar school and ended up in Cambridge, and he's come back home. And I think the presence of the university here is absolutely marvelous for the county. I like the idea. When I came here, I said, you know, I'd like to try out some new classes and maybe create some new programs. And I just got tremendous encouragement to do so. They were interested in my ideas. I wasn't bound by traditions and it has to be this particular way. And I also I like the students that are here because they're dynamic and they know this is a new place and they want to make the best of it, you know. And so,
does that resonate with yourself, Katie? Dynamic? What are you doing?
Yeah, it does.
There we are, you see. Celebrate. And that, Anna Lewis, is one of the reasons why you made a huge mistake in deciding to do your postgraduate work at the University of Kent at Canterbury. I shall say no more. Never mind. Other universities are available, but, you know, a shameless plug put together. Anna, have you got any questions you'd like to put to your namesake about the work of Isaac Newton, her work with science history, and anything else, really?
Well, I have, actually. I mean, okay. One of the things that I'd like to sort of share is, you probably know a lot about this, is the Wellcome Institute and how wonderful they are in London in making science come to life.
That's very true.
It's just an amazing, you know, I don't know what liaisons Wellcome has with anybody, but I mean, my experience of just going there as a passerby is amazing. Everyone, even from the security man who checks your bag to the people in the library, they're all really, really helpful.
They are. Yeah. They are. In fact, they've got Wellcome Images online, which is free and accessible. Wonderful collection of medical imagery, scientific imagery. There are Wellcome units at different universities. There was one at Oxford. I had the pleasure of being a research associate at, so I do a little history of medicine. Yes. I think that another thing where Wellcome is fairly exceptional is that they fund researchers to do what's called medical humanities. And that includes artists, musicians, as well as historians to look at how health and disease has shaped our lives and made a cultural impact in this era and in past eras. So it's a very exceptional organization, yes.
So it's thumbs up there, which is marvelous.
Thumbs up for Wellcome, yes.
We just heard from our colleagues at the Los Angeles Master Chorale, who are actually presenting a matinee and evening performance of Karl Orff's seminal, Carmina Burana. It was an old spike. No, we'll go dun, 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 dun. Very impressive. Anyway, featuring noted guest artists soprano Stacey Tappan and baritone Jose Adan Perez. And they're also listing, and we'll hopefully be featuring them in the very near future. You see, Los Angeles, Lincoln, I feel as though they're identical, but
absolutely.
For the weather.
But for the weather.
But yeah. For the weather. Yeah. Yes. I'm sure that Lily Holliman will be tuned into that. And of course, we're still going to Rachel Warby, who's the artistic director of Musique, probably one of the most innovative Pasadena based companies that are currently actually putting together a whole series of packages featuring an artist from Glee performing elements of the Beatles' White Album. Oh, extraordinary. Katie, would you like to put those last two questions to Anna Lewis?
Yes, I would. Anna, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
I have indeed. Thank you.
And can we look forward to connecting with you again?
You may indeed.
Yes, that's exactly. Great. Next week, a little tease ahead here. Do you know who we've got just slotting into this little feature, sort of sharing it with you, Anna, on the show next week? Jamie Anderson, the son of general wonderful creator of Thunderbirds and other things, Jerry Anderson. Jerry, of course, sadly passed away. Jamie is with us next week. A whole heap of other goodies there. Now, they're Thunderbirds without Isaac Newton.
That's right. He made the go in Thunderbirds Go, didn't he?
Precisely. Yeah. This is the whole critical factor which actually brings us the month of...